our general position is you should not pay. And the reason you should not pay is you want to be in the driver's seat. If you are, on the other hand, dead in the water, like I said, you know, you need the decryptor and you're stuck otherwise, then there's a good reason why you will have to pay. The biggest challenge is going to be, what is the quantum? If the demand is a couple $100,000 that you have insurance or not, most companies can pay it on their own. When it reaches multi-million dollars, that's where it becomes more tricky. No company, regardless of what their position is, wants to be known as an organization that paid X millions of dollars to threat actors.
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cyber Insurance Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Hess. Stay tuned.
Good afternoon and good morning to you, Imran. Thanks for coming to the show.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Yeah, it's definitely my pleasure. So, you know, I've been dying to talk with more folks in Canada. You know, I'm located in London. Obviously, I don't sound very London, but yeah, I thought it'd be great to have a chat with you about what's going on in Canada and sort of the market up there. So maybe to kick it off, maybe just do an intro about yourself first.
Sure. And thanks for having me on the show, Anthony. There's a lot happening in Canada, so looking forward to the conversation. But just by way of quick introduction for the audience, I'm a partner here at Norton Rose Fulbright Canada. I'm based actually in our Toronto and our Montreal offices. I split my time between the two. And I wear two different hats at the firm. Firstly, I'm the national chair of our technology law group. So I head up that expertise at our firm. And the second one is I co-chair with one of my very good partners, who you know, John Castle, based in our Calgary office, our team for cybersecurity, privacy, and data governance. And a big chunk of the work we do in that particular group is on what we call cyber incident response and cyber preparedness. So quite busy, as you can imagine, these days with everything that's coming in the media.
It's been amazing how busy it has been the last few months. I think there was definitely a drop off in ransomware last year, but it is certainly back with a vengeance. So I guess we kind of talked about, you know, yourself, your company, your team, your role, bit on geographies, you know, obviously focused on Canada. Maybe we could add in, you know, what size of clients do you really focus on?
So it's an interesting question. We Canada being sort of a mid-market economy, but a G7 country nonetheless, with very large, successful organization, pretty much has the full gamut of enterprises that get targeted by cybersecurity incident or thinking about cybersecurity more generally speaking. So we have a good mix. I think we'd say we have a lot of enterprise clients or large telecommunication firms, financial institutions across various industries, geographies in Canada, even from east to west, but also a very strong mid-market client base as well. Those who are extremely successful, you know, they would be, for example, in the $500 million range. And so in terms of revenue size or large number of employees. So pretty much the full gamut. I'd say we're probably less active in the very small SME area, but certainly in terms of mid-market and enterprise clients, definitely quite active in that space and across all industries.
Okay. Yeah, sounds good. What is your, would you say your kind of company strength is when it comes to cyber?
So I think if I had to sort of look at, you know, and there's some great law firms and breach coaches in the Canadian marketplace, I think one or two things that differentiate us is one, we probably have the largest cyber incident response team that's dedicated to cybersecurity in the country. So from coast to coast, from east to west, we have experts in pretty much all of our offices from Vancouver, Calgary, Montreal, Toronto, Quebec City, Ottawa, allowing us to have sort of local expertise, but with a national cohesive approach in terms of how we look at these incidents and how we respond to them effectively. So large scale, especially when you have aggregate events, when one incident or like a zero-day vulnerability can impact multiple clients at the same time, that allows us to deploy pretty quickly from our perspective. And then the other piece, which is obvious when you look at Norton Rose's global footprint, is the fact that we've got a very large global team, one where we can tap into our experts and colleagues in the US, EMEA, or any other part of the world where we have an office.
Okay. Yeah, great. So I thought, maybe I'm being a bit selfish here. I thought, you know, I'd always felt I was, it was easy for me to get confused trying to understand kind of sort of the background of Canadian breach response, kind of how it's all done there. And I have put some effort into trying to understand it, but I still find it super confusing. So I thought maybe we could kind of kick things off for people who are not so familiar with the Canadian kind of breach response and how it all works, and maybe some key points, key laws. I thought I'd just throw it out there. Like, what's the background of it? What would you think people should know?
Well, a variety of things, and I'll talk a little bit about the way it's set up right now, and then maybe where it's headed in the future, because we do have new laws kicking in Canada very soon. So historically, Canada being Canada, we're a federation, so we have multiple provinces, territories across the country, and our constitutional division of power is such that when it's within a particular jurisdiction, maybe it's a provincial jurisdiction, that province may have a particular role to play, which is more critical than, let's say, the federal government would. In other cases, the federal government will have a predominant or sole responsibility for something. In other instances, it will be actually a shared responsibility. So it can get quite confusing which law or laws will apply to an organization. But generally speaking, when it comes to cyber incident response, we're very similar to the US and US states in many ways, where you have, you know, a particular state law that talks about data breach. Here we talk about privacy legislation in particular. If it's within the province, Quebec, Alberta, BC have their own provincial private sector privacy laws. A lot of the provinces also have a public sector privacy law. And then you have sectoral laws like health, for example, which is also regulated by the provinces. But the federal government comes into play when you have data being transferred across borders, either between provinces or outside of Canada. So that's where you'll hear, for example, the term PIPEDA, which is our federal statute that kicks in, really focused on national and international data transfers and so on. So often what we're called upon to deal with the breach, certainly we can talk about the different types of instances that we're looking at, but when it deals with personal information, especially personal information of consumers in the commercial context, at that point, PIPEDA or a combination of PIPEDA and provincial laws may apply. And that's where we're trying to navigate those pieces. The other thing that's really interesting is for the longest time, our privacy laws were very much built around what we call an ombudsman model. So you would have the privacy regulator who doesn't have a ton of powers per se. Like, they can certainly investigate, they can certainly issue reports or make public statements and issue, in some very limited instances, fines. But they are not even comparable to what you see in Europe at all. So to sort of balance that back, or that pendulum being, you know, replaced to the right side, what the Canadian government and the provincial governments were looking at is, can we adopt a piece of legislation that will replace our privacy laws that exist already that are not particularly strong to be more in line with what we see in Europe with GDPR? And so Quebec kicked that off with Law 25, which came into force in different tranches, and next one coming up in September, so just in a few months, really with significant fines for non-compliance. So if you're offside, you could be fined a percentage of your global revenue, for example, which was not the case before. And then federally, to replace PIPEDA, we have this Bill C-27, which is being introduced, which is going to be very similar to what you have in Europe, with the exception that it's going to also have a specialized tribunal. So by and large, where we headed is a place where the enforcement regime, not just in privacy, but other areas as well, like financial institutions, are becoming significantly more onerous, which requires companies and organizations to navigate through a variety of laws and regulations.
Okay, interesting. So, you know, in terms of going forward then with these changes, do you think it'll make it easier to kind of understand what's going on, or know, you know, what law applies? Or do you think it's just going to make the enforcement harsher, but still similar kind of patchwork and confusing laws?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. I think on one hand, it's going to raise awareness because there are these significant fines that are being talked about. So people will be thinking of this as a compliance exercise that they have to go through, investing resources and time. So probably having a better handle on it. But there will be a period of time where there will be some level of uncertainty. There will be a gap period or challenges that come up with new laws. As you can imagine, you know, when we talk about significant multi, you know, global jurisdiction type of fines, you can be very concerned about, you know, what that's going to look like. And some organizations may challenge the premise on which the government is doing that. So I anticipate a period, not sure how long that will be, but an interim period where there will be some challenges for sure and some level of uncertainty.
Okay. Yeah, it's it'd be interesting to watch. You know, it feels like as long as I've been working in cyber insurance, at least, there's always been sort of a lot of activity in Canada, just in terms of the different laws coming into place and changes happening and things that are going to be coming. You know, I guess it's the same in the US. Maybe it's not the laws, but in terms of it being, you know, having, because you have kind of different regions, right? Like, you know, in the US, it's state, it's, you know, provinces in Canada, but it's kind of a similar concept where, you know, you've got different governments kind of involved, you know, at different levels of government. So, yeah.
Interestingly enough, I mentioned the privacy piece quite a bit, but there's also other pieces of legislation which are being proposed. So C26, which is a new piece of legislation that's being proposed, not law yet, but likely will be at some point in the near future, is really one to regulate what we call our critical infrastructure from a cybersecurity standpoint. So if you look at what the US has done with CISA, or the Critical Infrastructure Safety Agency, we're trying to mirror basically what they're doing here in Canada. So if you're a telecommunications firm, financial institution, energy company, an airport, a maritime port, you name it, some of those critical infrastructures that have been identified by public safety, chances are you're going to be caught by this new law. And when it does become law, at that point, you're going to be required to meet certain cybersecurity minimum thresholds and reporting obligations. So all to say, you know, historically, and you remember this, Anthony, years and years ago, you didn't have this concept of a breach coach. You had a privacy council, right? Then it morphed into insurance and became breach coach. You're seeing, you know, beyond privacy, certainly sectors like, you know, financial institutions with the Office of Superintendent of Financial Institutions here in Canada, or FSRA for the provincial regulator for credit unions, for example. Or you'll have, for example, like I just mentioned, on critical infrastructure, various new laws and regulations and standards and requirements being introduced in Canada, which was not the case before historically. So it is becoming a more complex environment, regulatory environment, at least to be able to navigate through.
Yeah, I think we have something called NIS here, and there was something before NIS, which is kind of similar in terms of it being in the UK focused on critical infrastructure. NIS obviously is pan-European. But yeah, it does make it a little more complex, and it's often, like you say, not so privacy focused. It's focused on, you know, broader cybersecurity, any kind of incident, which makes sense considering the potential impact. So I guess, you know, kind of going slightly different direction, what would you say, in your opinion, what are the three most important things to know cyber in the Canadian market? And this could be any of your top three things that you think are most important to consider or know about cyber in that market.
It's a great question. You know, if I had to give you my top three right off the top of my head, I'd say number one, but along the lines of what we're talking about, knowing exactly which laws apply to you. You know, you may be a hospital, for example, so you may have to navigate through provincial health. Maybe you have some aspect of your organization which is more commercial, you know, like a cafeteria or parking or what other services that you may be offering, that you may have a federal law that applies in some cases. So understanding where you situate yourself, and what your obligations are from that perspective, that's number one. I think number two, what advice we give to all of our clients is the preparation component, making sure you're extremely prepared. Often a lot of organizations are not sure what they're supposed to be doing and benchmarking themselves, and that can be very difficult. So depending on which industry you're in, what geography you're in, there are some standards you can reach out to your association or regulatory body that can provide you some insights. Third thing, may sound surprising or not surprising, not sure what the audience will think, but the insurance piece. Canada continues to grow as an insurance market, which is ripe for further adoption of cyber insurance. The penetration of cyber insurance in the Canadian marketplace, although very good, can grow even further from what I'm being told by brokers and other carriers. So there will be more of that. But again, the insurance policy for each insurance carrier varies in terms of verbiage and requirements and conditions. So just make sure you understand your policy well and that you're following it well so that you're maximizing the value that you have in it.
I think, you know, a few years ago, a lot of the insurers were maybe just kind of, they sort of put their foot into the Canadian market, but a lot of it was coming out of the US. And it seems like it's kind of growing more and more natively as the penetration in increases. You know, we see that in the UK as well, I guess. But yeah, so I guess, you know, I guess one of your first point of the three, I certainly, you know, and after the conversation we had before that, I certainly don't feel as bad about not quite being on top of all the different laws and regulations and whatnot. And so it makes a lot of sense that they should also, you know, really focus on knowing where they sit and prepping for it. So it seems like you could really catch yourself out. Like I see people making mistakes all the time with GDPR, which is a pretty simple law because it's consistent, you know, everywhere. Seems like it'd be much easier to do it wrong if you haven't prepped on the, you know, within the Canadian market. So cool. Well, I guess kind of talking about earlier, you know, I'd mentioned how busy it was compared to last year, or, you know, there was such a drop off due to ransomware. Certainly not a drop off now. You know, all the other kinds of incidents were really, we're still seeing those. And now ransomware has come back. What would you say, you know, are some of the key lessons that you've learned from dealing with so much ransomware over the years? You know, and what can people learn from that? What would you like to share with them maybe?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, there was a time where when we talked about preparedness, you know, clients would say, well, what can we do to prepare? What would be the best situation for us to be in? And talk to any cyber expert, lawyer, forensic firm, you know it. They were like, well, you have to have a plan. You have to have a cyber incident response plan or CARP and follow it. The interesting part is ransomware may have been mentioned in it as one type of cyber attack or type of tactic used by threat actors. Now what we see is, given the complexity around ransom payment, for all kinds of reasons that we can get into if you like, there are standalone ransomware playbooks with key factors to consider in terms of sanction verification that needs to be done, corporate policy on the ethics of payment or non-payment, especially those that are funded by public sector. So if you're a hospital in Canada, if you're a university in Canada, if you're a municipality, which are typically funded by the provincial governments, you know, are you comfortable making a payment of $1 million, $2 million, $3 million plus dollars to threat actors, knowing that some of these monies are actually coming from taxpayers, potentially if you don't have insurance, for example. So there's some ethical issues that come into play. Also, you know, what should the board or senior leadership be thinking about? It's not a binary pay or don't pay. What factors should they be thinking about? Where is it appropriate or not? And how can they, on their end, demonstrate they've done their due diligence? So to your question about, you know, what are we seeing that's different than it was before when it came to ransomware? What advice we're giving to our clients is, if you don't have it, get a ransomware playbook. You know, when would it be appropriate? It's not automatic that you pay or don't pay. And those are the two options. There are a lot of framework elements that go into how does that methodology employed? When do you think it's appropriate? Who makes the call? In fact, you know, I'll give you one example. Those three that I mentioned earlier, universities, hospital, and municipalities, if you are publicly funded, you need to get the minister involved. And it's not one minister. There could be multiple ministers depending on which industry you're in. So there's more complexity to it than there was in the past.
Yeah, payments are really interesting. You know, the one I guess everybody's really aware of from sort of a legal / regulatory kind of thing is OFAC in the US. And, you know, what would you say, you know, sort of the key concerns? I mean, you started to go and talk about it a bit, but like, what are the real concerns around payments? I'd love to dig into that a little more.
Sure. I mean, interestingly enough, you mentioned a year ago, well, you recall when Russia invaded Ukraine, there was a huge concern that all of a sudden we're going to see an uptick in ransomware attacks and so on. And what was interesting was almost on a weekly basis, you saw a country, you know, a part of the G7 or otherwise that were supporting the Ukrainians coming out with a new sanction list, you know, entities, individuals, and so on. And so a lot of the threat actors disbanded and reformed themselves, you know, with a new name, but were really affiliated to a predecessor group that existed prior to the invasion. And so one of the big concerns in those early days was, even if a sanction check came back clear, so you mentioned OFAC, could be a variety of others as well, or a combination of, are you going to be comfortable potentially paying an entity that's not on a list today, but on a list tomorrow? Because we just, the cadence was so high. That's now stabilized quite a bit. You have the same threat actors. It's pretty stable in terms of, you know who you're dealing with. And a lot of these ransom negotiation firms will do their due diligence, give you some intel, you know, which group is affiliated with whom and so on. So less of a concern today than it was maybe a year ago plus. around that range. But other factors to keep in mind would be some of the things I just mentioned to you. Are we, as a corporate board of, let's say, fill in the blank, critical infrastructure? Let's say it's a financial institution. Are we comfortable making a payment? If we were asked, would we do this? You know, do we engage with law enforcement before or after in terms of our intention or our ability to pay these amounts? What about the quantum of the amount that's being asked for? And really, the framework, if you had to simplify it, there's three key scenarios where you would contemplate to pay a ransom. And just as a general proposition, we don't encourage payment. You know, we want to avoid the situation. But if you have to, here's what you would look for. One is you're dead in the water. Without a decryptor, you cannot operate as a going concern. So either that you're fully encrypted, you don't have ability to access backup for restoration purposes, or that the restoration would take too long and there's other critical milestones like a financial audit coming up in your publicly listed company. There may be factors that drive you to get the decrypted data back first and foremost. So you're really paying for the decryptor primarily, and that could be a reason why you engage to make a payment. The second scenario is you can restore. It may take some time, and typically it does, because you want to do it securely as possible. But the threat actor would have stolen some data that is of significant value to you. And I do emphasize to the clients, this is not embarrassing data. This is sensitive data. This could be IP, could be third-party data that belongs to them that if it was ever made public would be a problem, could be other types of information that are uber critical to the organization. So not embarrassing emails. But really, like, we're talking about intellectual property, trade secret, that quality of information. And at that point, you're not paying for the decryptor. You're paying for the suppression or deletion or return of the data itself, so it doesn't get into the public realm. Third scenario, which we never recommend, and there's a lot of risk to it, is what we call nuisance payment. So a lot of these threat actors, as you know, Anthony, spend a lot of time and effort trying to get into your environment. They'll take if it drags on, they'll take 10 cents on the dollar as opposed to nothing at all. And in those situations, if they do, that may be a good solution for some organizations because they don't want their name published out there and the data won't be leaked out and they feel they haven't paid the full amount. But the flip side is, because it's a chain and it's affiliate group, you never know if they can re-extort you. You don't know about the comfort level you're going to get about the assurances they've provided to you that data has indeed been deleted across their entire affiliate group. And then probably more importantly, insurers don't typically look favorably to nuisance payment because you don't actually have to. It's convenience payment that you're making more than anything else. So there's some risk there as well that you may be paying either out of pocket or that the party that you're dealing with recognizing they're criminals, are not a reliable partner to do business with for that type of transaction.
Okay. Yeah, that's that makes sense. So I guess, and obviously ransomware has kind of been the big story the last 5 years. You know, we see a lot of business email compromise, which is kind of what Asera started with. We also see a good amount of, you know, sort of tax fraud in the US. W-2 fraud seems very common. We do quite a few of those. What would you say, you know, in terms of incidents, like, is that pretty much what you guys see too? Is it mostly BEC or ransomware, or is there a lot of other things you're seeing going on?
Those are the main ones, but I'll tell you, it sort of fluctuates. So the two additional ones we saw this year that were prevalent, oddly enough, at the beginning of the year, we saw a lot of DDoS attacks of all things, typically coupled with the second one, which is data exfiltration. So threat actor gets in. They steal your data. You don't really realize what's going on at all because, you know, it's business as usual. And then you get a ransom note and you say, well, this looks like a bit frivolous. I have no way of knowing if they actually took this data or not, or what level of data they do have. And then to demonstrate they have the ability, they will do a DDoS attack on the target organization or the victim organization and in the ability to be able to extort them for the payment at the end day. That we've seen a bit more of. It's still a bit of an outlier. It's not the norm. But we do see more of it.
That's interesting. Yeah. You know, DDoS, it kind of felt like for a while it had gone away, but I suppose, you know, like we see it with Move IT or Move It, I guess, as well, you know, the attackers are getting more innovative as companies are building up a lot of resilience to ransomware or put MFA in place to protect against business email compromise. They're kind of looking at other ways again. So it's kind of like, you know, it's coming back.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the different types of tactics like ransomware, BEC, but you make a really good point about Move It. You know, MOVEit was unique, Go Anywhere just before that, and there have been tons of others in terms of zero-day vulnerabilities. But I think what we struggle with our clients the most, and the clients struggle with this a lot, is supply chain breaches. So your environment has been compromised, a third party has been, and now you're dependent on them to share information in a timely way. So you get that notice, right? The 24 hours, we've had a breach, we're letting you know, because we're a business partner, we're required to do so under our contract. And then nothing for a week, 2 weeks. And as I mentioned earlier, there are a lot more new laws that require you to notify either regulators or individuals. We don't have very tight prescribed timeframes, but we do have timeframes. You can't just sit on it until the other party decides to finish his investigation. So it puts the entity that received the notice from the supplier or the supply chain in a very difficult situation. Do they go ahead of time when they don't have any information, notify various regulators, the risk that they may be over notifying something that's frivolous or not as significant or material as it should be? Or do they wait and then find out it's much bigger and they get questioned, why did you wait so long? Those are very difficult to manage. If your contracts are not drafted in a way where you have good visibility and cooperation from the vendor, it can be quite challenging.
Okay. Yeah. That's, it's an interesting one. I guess I have seen that in the past, certainly where it was difficult to get, you know, suppliers to cooperate, you know, especially managed service provider, perhaps, you know, not wanting to share information with clients and whatnot. Yeah, that was, that can be a tricky one for sure. Okay. Well, I guess, you know, we talked a bit about this, and I don't know if I should ask it, but I think there may be some other different elements too that you might want to recommend. So here's the question, now that I've sort of introduced it. If there's one piece of cyber advice you could give to companies that you haven't already given, because you did talk about prep earlier, and then, you know, it would be something other than that. What kind of advice would you give to companies? Like, what should they be doing?
I'll give a few tactical suggestions, if that's okay. I think the strategy piece we touched on, the preparation, that's covered off. The two tactical suggestions I would have is, one, you may have an incident response plan, but make sure your IRP has a list of key vendors that you want to work with. And it may sound obvious, but you need to have primary and secondaries and think through the whole response chain. So breach coach is one, that's fine. But you want to also have a forensic firm. But a forensic firm, you have to break it down in terms of expertise. Like you just mentioned, you know, you guys started out doing a lot of BECs. That's a unique expertise. You can go in very quickly, investigate, and be out and give some assurances or you know, next steps to the organization. But you want to have people who know that particular type of risk well. So if you're dealing with a state actor, you're going to make sure you're going to have a vendor who's dealt with a state actor kind of adversary. So having those vendors outlined in terms of expertise, primary and secondaries, because I've seen in aggregate events like the Move IT one, where folks are either they don't have capacity or they're conflicted. So have your primary and secondary. And then in addition to that, think about other pieces that come to mind. A lot of people say, well, I've got my lawyer, I've got my breach coach, I've got my PR firm, I'm good to go. Well, what about the ransom negotiator and the settlement firm? Maybe they can do both or maybe they can't. Think about also boots on the ground. Some folks don't need it. They can do it all remotely. Others may need actual people going to computers and literally turning them on and doing the work that has to be done on it. So think through the various items that relate to your IT environment, your different locations, and so on. So that in terms of having your vendors identified, primary, secondary, and the whole slew that you would need of vendors should be very, very clear in your incident response plan. And then the other piece of advice, which is a tactic one, is making sure you understand your data. This sounds obvious, but just think of emails, for example. How many people have emails that go back 10, 15 years? The most challenging and frustrating ones I'm sure that you see as well is, yeah, we had an employee, he or she kept data for the last 15 years. There's gigs and gigs of data. Oh yeah, there may have been some personal information we never really archived. And, you know, we have Office 365, but we didn't use the right license. So now we have to do a full-on e-discovery on it. And that's going to take weeks and weeks and weeks to do. So it can become challenging in some cases. So understanding your data in your emails is one example, but broadening your environment as well.
I love that one because I'm a digital pack rat and I have the control of that is taken away from me. It's like, no, Anthony, we're archiving your data. No, wait, I want it here. I want it. Why do you need it? Well, I don't know. It feels good to have it. So it is. It is a funny one. That I like the point on, you know, sort of the different vendors being good at different things. I'd say, you know, like I do a lot of our service development. You know, I get really involved in it, and kind of going through incident type by incident type, and saying, right, we do this. We've got skill sets. We're strong at this. This part of the incident, no, we don't do that. Let's outsource that, or, you know, set up a partner agreement, or, you know, however you want to do it, subcontract, partner agreement, et cetera. And so we had to do that for every kind of key incident type that we see. You know, and a lot of what we do, we send bits and pieces to other folks. Like if we're doing, you know, we don't do manual reviews, for example, or we don't do ransomware payments, and we don't even try to, and we're quite open about that. We say, look, you know, we don't want to do that bit. These are experts over here. And so, yeah, there's kind of things that if you haven't thought it through, like you may not have pieces of the chain that you think you do. And, you know, if you're relying on vendor, I mean, I think if you're working with really good IR firms, they'll probably at least have thought it through as I did, but there might be others, you know, and it's always amazing to me. A lot of companies haven't thought through, like, how are we going to work with our DFIR vendor, or how are we going to work with our breach coach? And they just kind of assume, oh, well, we have a lawyer. Oh, but is that law firm, do they have a lot of expertise in managing cyber incidents? Or, you know, even if you're prepping with them, are there privacy experts? You know, can they really help you prepare for it? So yeah, I really like both those recommendations. Well, I would say probably the second one I don't like because I am a pack rat. But the other one I'll go with. I wish I could hold all the data all the time, you know, like if I could just have it just right there and I could just search for it.
I know. And it's tempting, right? And you know, I'll tell you the accounts, the email accounts that get compromised that belong to an HR person who ran a spreadsheet on people's salaries with their date of birth and social insurance on it. Not because they had any bad intent, and it was like from 5 years ago and has hundreds or thousands of people. Gosh, those are frustrating, A, to find, but more importantly, then you have to notify because you don't know if the data was taken or not.
Well, like, you know, too, if people don't go through, I've seen this too, like older systems, like maybe, let's say most databases or whatever type of system nowadays, you know, they're built to protect the data. They're secure, it's encrypted at rest, all these sorts of things. But people that don't get rid of the older data, like maybe five versions ago of whatever payroll software was storing it locally unencrypted, you know, from 2008, and nobody ever deleted it. And it's like, that's the worst thing, because you're just like, oh, why did you kept it, and you kept it in the old format, and we're going to have to notify all those people from, you know, data that's so old, but it's still sensitive. You know, people not sort of prepping for that is probably very frustrating when you're paying, certainly. So cool. Well, I guess talking about paying and talking about ransom payments, we kind of touched on it a bit before, the insurer side of it. I've seen out there, you know, people talk about, oh, does insurance drive ransomware payments, or are insured customers less likely to pay because they have good advice? Like, what are your thoughts on that? You know, does it make a difference, people kind of using their insurance response capability, you know, in the panels that are built, or, you know, people like other ones who have not done that? Is there a difference in terms of who pays or doesn't pay?
It's a good question. I'd say pandemic, probably a different response would have come from me. But I think where we're at now, a few years afterwards, I think everybody looks at it more or less the same way, that it be the insurer's money or their own money, if you wish, because they don't have insurance or they don't have extortion coverage. I haven't seen a big distinction. I think with the advice, it really depends on the advice you're getting from counsel. A lot of clients, and it's not to overstate the role of the breach coach, a lot of folks are going to ask, like, what do you see in the market, Imran? Like, what is Norton Rose advising? Like, what are other clients doing, generally speaking? Are they paying or not paying? And like I said earlier, our general position is you should not pay. And the reason you should not pay is you want to be in the driver's seat. If you are, on the other hand, dead in the water, like I said, you know, you need the decryptor and you're stuck otherwise, then there's a good reason why you will have to pay. The biggest challenge is going to be, what is the quantum? If the demand is a couple hundred thousand dollars that you have insurance or not, most companies can pay it on their own. When it reaches multi-million dollars, that's where it becomes more tricky. No company, regardless of what their position is, wants to be known as an organization that paid X millions of dollars to threat actors. If they can avoid it, they will. So I think, you know, when there's a decryptor requirement involved, and I use the word requirement very intentionally, like you cannot operate but without the decryptor. At that point, there's a bigger driver to make it. And then the second sort of threshold is, what's the quantum of the demand? If it's, like I said, multi-million, people may back off. In some cases, not. In other cases where it's really low, they may just say, okay, you know what, let's just pay it because it'll be a quicker way to proceed in this one.
Okay, cool. Well, I guess next topic is, you know, I often like to ask people, you know, what they consider really important, how they measure themselves, how they measure their teams. Like, how would you say you do that? What's really important to you in your role?
I'll tell you this much. Cyber incident response, I do find it's a bit of a unique field for lawyers because it's intense. You're always on. The clients need you, which is totally fine. There is no downtime. And more importantly, they're making very big decisions in some cases that they've never had to deal with before. Like, I've dealt with CFOs and other senior executives who are extremely accomplished in their own right. But when they get into these kind of situations, rightly so, they, in some cases, they're quite stressed out. In some cases, I've seen them in tears. In other cases, I've seen them panic. It's quite normal. Our job is to make sure that we're available to them, that we walk them through what the process is, that we take the time to explain what that process is and how we're going to get to the finish line. It is not so much responding, you know, one piece at a time, but having a bigger picture where you're going to land and how all these pieces will fall into place. And you have to have some level of flexibility in there. And things always happen, right? I mean, in the best of cases, there will be something that's unpredictable that occurs. And at that point, you need to be able to pivot and give answers pretty quickly. The other thing I'll just say, for breach coaches and for young folks who are trying to get into the breach coaching space, I always tell them this. This is very different than, let's say, being a litigator. You know, a litigator will have time to think through the issues, look at the law, draft a memo, maybe even draft their pleadings over a period of days or weeks. In our business, you don't have days and weeks to give client advice. You are going to be solicited for your experience. You're going to be solicited for, you know, benchmarking industries and then being able to give quick answers, and not just a quick one, which is written down, but like in front of board members who are going to challenge you in some cases, or senior leadership that are going to say, why would I do this? I'm not going to do this, or explain to me how this is legal and why I can or cannot do something. Those are not easy decisions or conversations to have. So that's the challenging part of the job. But the flip side is those clients, they're with you for pretty much your entire life afterwards. When you've been in the foxhole with them, they will call you for everything and anything. So it's a good relationship you build over time as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you definitely do build that intense relationship in those sorts of situations, I guess. Those intense, you know, you kind of, they expose who people really are. And so you're able to build a tight relationship quickly because, you know, you get to know each other and how you respond under pressure really well. It's a great point. Just kind of talking about team a little bit, you know, what would you say your team's biggest challenges, and what are some of the things you do to address those challenges or challenge?
I think, you know, we're so lucky at our firm to have really good clients and a good volume of work come in. So we're always busy. The hours are never the issue. I think the challenge is just making sure we pace ourselves so that the younger lawyers especially have a chance to take a step back, focus on other things on life too, right? Like, they've got families and other things other than work. Taking, you know, you're always so involved in the client's situation that you want to be there for them. You know, I always tell our associates, especially the younger ones, like, take the time you need for yourself as well. Mark it in your calendar. I'm going to be away from this day to this day ahead of time. So and stick with it unless something crazy urgent happened. And luckily with our team, we have such a large group. The way we address it is we basically have buddies, you know, if you want to call it that. So if you had planned a vacation the first week of July, for example, don't move the vacation. You've got colleagues. We can scale up. We can bring our colleagues in who can, you know, step in for you while you're away, so the client doesn't have any sort of gap in the service. But with the same token, you get a benefit of, you know, disconnecting. And the person you're leaving behind, who's going to be managing the client, has the same level of expertise or more to be able to support them. So that's what I recommend. You know, teams and size of your team does matter, and the experience does matter.
But just talking about kind of the work-life balance, you know, it is so hard in what we do and sort of the incident response to get away. Maybe it's a broader question. I mean, is it like, I think Americans, especially over the last 20 years or 30 years, maybe have become fantastically bad at disconnecting. I was just, you know, talk with this people about this sometimes. I think in the UK, we're a bit better at it. You know, obviously continental Europe, depending on which country, you know, people often have impressions, you know, and it may not match how it really is in various countries. But I guess to get to my point, like, do you think people are pretty good in general at properly disconnecting and handing over in sort of the Canadian culture, you know, workplace culture?
I think it's a struggle everywhere. I don't think it's any, I think in cyber, it's probably more of a struggle. I'll give you an example. If you're, let's say, a corporate lawyer working on a deal, you'll be working really intensely for a period of time. Or if you know a deal is coming down the pike, you can pace yourself, you can build your team, you have some visibility on it. So it's a bit easier, I'd say, comparatively speaking, to manage. You may speak to the clients maybe once or twice or three times a week in that kind of context. In our case, you're talking to the client 3-4 times a day, and not just one day, but multiple days. And if you're not available, client gets very uncomfortable. They get nervous because, like I said, they haven't gone through this in most cases before. And our role as breach coach, which is in the term, is to coach them, is to tell them, here's what's coming next. Here's why you should not panic when the threat actor starts phoning your employees and doing anything crazy. You know, those are the kind of things they rely on us. So I think for cyber lawyers who are in particular involved in the incident response side of things, it is significantly more difficult. Like, it is a challenge. I mean, we're lucky to have a great team that's pretty dedicated and they want to do this kind of work. But I do see in the industry, generally speaking, and then maybe more in Canada as well, some of the younger lawyers getting into it, super excited. It's interesting. It is an adrenaline rush. I think I cannot maintain this for 5, 6, 7, 10, 15 years, whatever it's going to be. It is tough. It is a tough profession.
Yeah, that makes sense. I feel like, I don't know, I guess from my perspective, I almost feel like it became easier over time. Like, I'm very bad at disconnecting, but I don't get stressed out by it the way I might have 10 or 15 years ago, because it's sort of like you've done it before. So the emotional drain isn't there, but it, you know, I always worry about that for my team. It's like, you know, is everybody okay? You know, everybody taking enough time off? Did you get a 3-day weekend? Whatever the case may be. It is just so difficult in, I guess, professional services, but especially cyber, you know, and cyber incidents.
The other thing, Anthony, I'm sure you've seen this as well, is, you know, and you said that you started out doing a lot of these BECs recently. There's always this risk of also falling into, oh, it's the same one. Same MO. Well, sometimes it's not. And you have to be, we're almost like investigators ourselves as lawyers, where, hold on, tell me more. Why is this different? You know, how could this be different? And then sort of honing on any kind of unique aspect. I mean, you talked about BEC in the context maybe even of social engineering and financial fraud, right? Not all financial frauds are the same. And there are sometimes a chance of recovery of funds. It's not just because it's been more than 72 hours, there's zero chances. There are things you want to think about and ask questions and figure out. So the other risk is you do so many of these, like you said, right? That, you know, the younger folks go, well, it's rinse and repeat. No, it's not. Sometimes you have really, each one has to be treated as a unique case coming in.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think, you know, I think as the technology gets better, the computer gets better and better, you know, the AI or whatever, you know, will get better and better at saying, hey, this looks unusual compared to what we've seen before. But as far as it is today, definitely, you know, I guess that's the thing that always jumps out at me is like, oh, wait a minute. How is, like, when I'm reviewing reports and whatnot, it's like, oh, this is kind of interesting. This is a different approach. Or because it is, I sometimes tell people, I'm like, oh, it's always the same. Everything's the same. It's the same as it always was. And that is true at a very high level, you know, but once you get into the details, you're like, oh, this is kind of different. That's different. Okay. This is an interesting shift in how the attacker, you know, is approaching it. You kind of think, right, well, why are they doing that? Like, what's causing that trend? You kind of say, oh, okay, well, it's because companies are doing this now. So the attackers changed their approach by doing that. And I think it's really interesting.
Just
kind of looking across the industry then. So if you're, I like to sort of a theoretical question. So don't worry about antitrust consideration. If you had 10 of your peers in a room, what question would you ask them?
You know, my biggest question would be on practical things such as team management and, you know, what are they finding as difficult tactics to respond to? There's value in getting expertise from your peers. And, you know, I'll be honest with you. I do reach out to my breach colleagues and we'll have coffee or talk about, you know, what are we seeing in the industry broadly? You know, I mentioned to you earlier, exfiltration plus DDoS. I did reach out to a couple of other breach coaches, say, are you seeing this as well? There's value in sharing intel or practices. Nothing wrong with that. So I wouldn't have a specific question, but I would talk about, you know, if they're leading teams, for example, at their law firm, how are they finding talent? You know, how are they training the talent? How are they scaling up? Those kind of things are always of great interest to me. And then more specifically to, you know, what are they seeing in the marketplace in terms of tactics being used by threat actors?
Okay. Yeah, that's those are both really interesting. Talent's always a challenge. It's definitely one for us. I spend a lot of our time recruiting and thinking about recruiting and thinking about skills and how to find the right people, just kind of on our side of it. So it definitely makes a lot of sense. Cool. I have one more question then from sort of the thought leadership. And then I have kind of some rapid fire closing questions I like to ask as well. Last question I have is just, you know, I like to know what people find interesting that's going on sort of in the cyber news. Like, you know, current events, what do you find interesting?
I'm tracking the zero-day vulnerability tactic. What surprised me was Go Anywhere happened, not that it happened, but it did happen. And then in very short succession, you had the Move IT one occur. And the tactic that the threat actor used, which was, you know, we're not going to really go after you and ask you to come and talk to us. We're just saying you got to talk to us by June 14th. Otherwise, we dump your data. Which is now interesting that they're sort of shifting the onus on engaging with them in that fashion and using zero-day vulnerability to attack not just one, but multiple organizations. I find that tactic interesting. I'm curious to see if that's a new approach or a new method that's going to be used on a go-forward basis. Because remember, I mean, a zero-day vulnerability does require effort. There is investment by the threat actor. That will be interesting to see.
It has been, it is pretty wild. And I think the impact is so severe because of the fact that they basically, you know, are just spreading everyone's data all over the place without really engaging with them. So there's probably companies out there that had no idea, you know, they were affected and all until they saw it on a website all of a sudden. And then at that point, the data's leaked, right? There's no way to prevent it from happening. And so it's a pretty big impact. I guess we'll see. You know, I compare it to sort of the exchange vulnerabilities of a couple of years ago, which we saw an enormous number of cases around sort of the proxy log on proxy shell, which kind of was like a slow motion, you know, anyone who hadn't patched, you know, they're like, they're getting hit. But it went on for quite a while, like at least 6 months, which was interesting because it was such a high profile vulnerability. This one's kind of like wham, all of a sudden just massive sweep, and then there's data getting thrown out onto the web. So it'll be fascinating to see which kind of approach, you know, are they able to make more money off of, and how will it go going forward. So yeah, definitely fascinating to see. I'd like to ask just a couple more questions. How did you get into the insurance/legal industry? So you can kind of go either way or both directions in your case, if you want to.
Both were accidental, not planned. I never thought I would make the kind of friends I made in insurance and knew nothing about insurance industry, generally speaking. And I certainly didn't know anything about law. My family's not in law. I sort of just stumbled into it. Both were happenstance and great ones if you look at it now in hindsight.
Okay. So it was definitely accidental. I think we often see that where it's just kind of a funny story and somebody ends up in it.
If you're interested in a funny story. So the way I got into cyber was interesting. I like cybersecurity specifically. So this is going, so I started out as a technology lawyer. That was what my training was. And I had one client I was working with who was expanding into Canada. So they were using a franchise model. So the corporate entity had set up their shop here in Canada. They're about to get franchisees to obviously copy the model. And they had a breach. And that particular company had data that belonged to a particular Toronto Star journalist. And they were concerned that, you know, they were an American company expanding in Canada, first location, model for all the franchisees. And we're concerned this is going to hurt the brand in a big way. And we walked them through that piece. And I went to the managing partner after the file had been dealt with. And I said, we should start a cybersecurity group. He said, okay, sounds like a good idea. Why don't you go ask some of the partners? And this is going back 12, 15 years now, almost, give and take. And I went to the managing partner and he said, yeah, go find a partner or some partners who will be able to take this on and you can be the person who supports him, because I was a junior at that time, and then see where it goes. And nobody was interested. They thought cybersecurity was a Y2K passing fad. It wasn't real. There was no Cybersecurity Act at the time, obviously, so they weren't clear what exactly we'd be doing. Some confuse it with like online libel and defamation work, which is it is not. Anyway, so I went back to the managing partner and said, look, I'm struck out. We're not getting any traction here. Nobody's interested. You know, credit to him. He said, look, I think you have something here. Why don't you go ahead and build this out, Imran, and see where it goes. And here we are many, many years later. And there were many years in the desert. Like, you know, clients were like, this is not happening. This is not interesting. And then Home Depot, Sony, and Target happened in quick succession. And in Canada, it sort of took off at that point, more so than it was maybe in the US. Was always a few years ahead of us in cyber. And yeah, right place at the right time, support from the firm. Everything just worked out well.
Yeah, that was 2014, I guess, would have been those incidents, right? I think it was 2014. It was an interesting year. And I think that was when a lot of people really started paying attention. I mean, I guess, you know, in the US, it was maybe a bit earlier. Oh, I'm struggling to remember the names, probably 2006, maybe 2007. And obviously, there was different laws that were coming into play. But yeah, certainly those big ones that happened really got people to pay attention. And then, you know, I guess it's funny now when I look back, it's like the last 6-7 years is the rise of ransomware. And it's, and I don't know if it's a COVID thing or just like, how many years has this been? That, you know, I think a ransomware is like the new thing. You're like, oh, it's been.
Well, it's funny. I mean, ransomware, you remember, like, was a non-issue, right? Like, if the client, like back in the day when there was no exfiltration going on, which was, by the way, the norm, there was no exfiltration going on. You know, if you had backups, you were rock solid. You didn't actually need to do it. And actually, the role of the breach coach was irrelevant. Like, what are we going to advise on? Yeah, go ahead, do this.
I used to split it. So I would split the routing. Like, okay, if it's a ransomware, you know, just send, you know, it's a technical problem. Send the tech company to go deal with it. If it's a, you know, data theft, data breach kind of situation, then, you know, engage a law firm. And so, yeah, it's, things have definitely changed a lot. So yeah, that's funny to think though, that when you started, you know, I guess it's, sometimes you see it internationally, like when I don't think there was a lot of interest in the company I was working in for cyber insurance at the time I started doing it. Like, there was a few people that were interested in it. But for the most part, it's like, oh, what's that? And it's, you know, being outside of the US, much smaller market, much less, you know, the insurance market was a lot more built up in the States, you know, by the time I started working in cyber insurance. It's not that dissimilar of a story. Like, okay, I'll do it, I guess. I mean, I'll figure this thing out. Why not? So cool. Well, what would you, so next question, what would you recommend to anyone who wants to have a successful career in the legal industry, let's say?
Oh, okay. More broadly legal. That's interesting.
It can be cyber if you want to give them sort of cyber lawyer, you know.
No. This is a great, great question, because I was having a conversation with our CFO the other day, and you know, she's a numbers person, and she asked me, like, Imran, you know, are you, you know, you teach at University of Toronto and at the University of Montreal, are you aware in the faculties if they're teaching any course on the business of law?
Yeah.
And the shorter answer is I'm not aware of any. If there is any research being done on that piece or teaching being done, it's at the, you know, graduate chair research level, not definitely a part of the curriculum. So I think anybody who is in the legal field or wanting to get into the legal field, like, look, I'm all in favor of knowing the law, it's table stakes, you know, it's the minimum price of entry, knowing the law and being a good lawyer. But in addition to it is the business of law, and the business of law, not just so much in terms of dollars and cents, but in terms of the customer service, if you want to call it that, you know, making sure you understand, you know, I say this jokingly, but it's actually true. You're not just a client's lawyer. When you're a breach coach, for example, you're also, in a way, their friend, their advisor, their psychologist when they're stressed out in some ways. Like, you know, you play a lot of different roles, and being available pretty much all the time. And I know it's not for everyone, and I'm not saying you should be, but for those who are in the cyberspace, sometimes, you know, you know, clients do value that and require that when you're dealing with it. That's not in the job description when you become a lawyer, right? When you go through law school, your article, and then you get called to the bar, the thought is, okay, I'm going to give legal advice and that'll be it. But there's a bigger business to law component, the client relationship piece, which I think we still have to invest in, despite the fact we've got so many technology tools like the chats and the text messaging, which clients do, but it's not a replacement for the human relationship piece to it.
I really like that one, sort of the other elements of being a lawyer. Okay, cool. Last question I like to ask is, who should our next podcast guest be? Who would you love to see?
I don't know who you've had in the past necessarily. You may have covered this already, but I'd love to hear from a ransom negotiator, sort of the back end discussions. I mean, I see the chats, but I'd love to see what that actually feels like and how they engage and how they got into that space and how they sort of learned their tactics. So that'd be super interesting.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah. I'm going to give that some thought. I wonder if it's possible to do something like that, because that could be really interesting. It would be unique as well. We have not had someone who was focused on that as sort of their career. I have some ideas, but yeah, well, cool. Well, thanks a lot for that suggestion. And thanks a lot for coming on the show.
No, thanks for having me. This was great. Really enjoyed the conversation.
If you want to learn more about our host, Anthony, or his company, Aceris, visit aceris.com. aceris.com. Thanks to our friends at Savoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.